I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. In the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's easy to overlook that we've been in the middle of a public health emergency for nearly 4 years now. And it's not just in Vancouver that has been affected by the opioid crisis. The number of victims from illicit drug overdoses are in the thousands. And because of the nature of their deaths, these people are largely invisible. A new book shines a light on the epidemic, challenging the misconceptions we might have about drugs, crime, and addiction. Benjamin Perrin is the author of Overdose, Heartbreak and Hope in Canada's Opioid Crisis. In the book, he provides a narrative of the crisis and the consequences on our society and our cities. He also conducts comprehensive interviews with people on the front line, people in law enforcement and healthcare. He talks to drug users and border agents, as well as those in the Indigenous community whose numbers are overrepresented in this crisis. There are solutions proposed in the book, as well as a declaration that confirms how we are all part of a way forward. I'll ask Professor Perrin about the role of law enforcement as he'd like to see it, as well as the moralistic way we've looked at drugs, drug use, and addiction, and how we might get away from that. And I'll get Benjamin's insight into how politics plays a part, not just in the calculations that politicians make, but just how difficult it is to get things done in Ottawa. Benjamin Perrin is a professor of law at the University of British Columbia. He is a senior fellow in criminal justice at the MacDonald Laurier Institute of Public Policy. He served as a law clerk at the Supreme Court of Canada and was the lead justice and public safety advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper from 2012 to 2013. His previous books are Invisible Chains, Canada's Underground World of Human Trafficking, and Victim Law, the Law of Victims of Crime in Canada. Visit overdosebook.ca for more information, as well as a virtual launch of the book beginning Thursday, the 16th of April at 5 p.m. Pacific Time. This new book is published by Viking. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Benjamin Perrin. Professor Perrin, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I'd like to begin not with the book itself, but the book tour. You were set to tour the country, but obviously plans have changed because of caution over COVID-19. But on April 16th on your website, overdosebook.ca, people can log on there at, I understand, 5 p.m. Pacific? And what's happening there?
Yeah, that's right. We are going to be producing a sort of short video for people who can participate from anywhere in the world now and not just having to come to these events, where they'll be able to hear, not just from myself, but a few of the other people, some of the experts, people who have lost loved ones to a drug overdose, and they'll be sharing their stories. And so it's unfortunate that we can't meet in person, but we're hopeful that people will log on, and after that I'll be online and happy to answer questions and hear comments from people who have attended that event or have read the book already or are planning to or have concerns about this issue.
It's an important issue, obviously. It's an issue that not only consumes those of us here in Vancouver, but across the country. I mean, the opioid crisis is, you know, it's throughout North America. Are you worried with all the focus on COVID that the message at the heart of this book will get drowned out, even though, I mean, the opioid crisis has been a public health emergency for 4 years now?
Yeah, what's really remarkable is if you look at the fact that we are in the middle of two simultaneous public health emergencies, the COVID-19 pandemic and the opioid epidemic. And I'm actually very concerned, as are others who I've spoken with since the COVID-19 outbreak has taken hold, of what is going to happen when these two things come together. We're already starting to see very troubling signs of that. And This is the opioid crisis is Canada's forgotten public health emergency. We've had over 14,000 people have died since 2016. That's a person dying almost every 2 hours a few years ago when they did that calculation. And we've really neglected this crisis. And as a result, we're now dealing with two simultaneous emergencies, and they are affecting each other. And if we don't immediately take action to respond to the opioid crisis in the context of COVID-19, we are going to see even worse things to come.
You start the book by saying that it was a prayer that got you started on this research journey. What were you seeing that compelled you to want to do more?
Well, I had an interesting kind of background. I mean, I was Prime Minister Stephen Harper's top criminal justice advisor in 2012 and 2013. At that time, I hadn't given any thought to drug policy. My work was on issues related to victims of crime. I really sort of bought into the conservative dogma that drugs are bad, so we should criminalize them and, you know, punish anyone who and stop anything that would possibly facilitate or enable them. So I, you know, had a knee-jerk reaction of ideological opposition to things like supervised consumption sites, to, you know, obviously decriminalizing drugs was completely out of the question. And so when I moved back to Vancouver and began to take up my job as a law professor at UBC, I began to see, you know, story after story of people overdosing and dying in the community. And then in 2016, a public health emergency was declared for the opioid crisis in British Columbia. And it bothered me. It bothered me that I'd been part of a government that set up our modern approach to a modern war on drugs that clearly was failing to address this crisis. It also bothered me on a moral level, that I didn't seem to care more, that people were dying and I was just going about my business. And so, yeah, I grew up, you know, going to church, but I really didn't have a relationship with God. I really was living a life for myself and my own career and ambitions and selfish desires. And so I prayed one day on the way to work. I asked for God to give me a heart of compassion for people who are dying from the overdose crisis. And that was a spark. That was a spark that started an investigation that led me to the back alleys of the downtown east side, that would lead me to sit in front of mothers who've lost loved ones, their children, to drug overdose deaths, to the police stations and the crime units, to the addiction centers and the courtrooms, you name it. I talked to everyone I could who had anything to say about this issue. And it led to a real change of heart and mind for me, a complete transformation to now being a strong advocate for a compassionate, evidence-based approach to drug policy that includes a safe supply, that includes harm reduction, that includes decriminalizing people who use drugs.
We'll get into some of these aspects that you talk about in the book in just a sec, but you also write near the beginning of the book that many people in our society are living with deep pain and unresolved trauma. They need our compassion, not our condemnation. Why do you think it is, Professor Perrin, that a place of compassion is so hard for so many people to get to?
Well, you know, like many people, you know, I grew up in the 1980s, and it was all about, you know, say no to drugs and the DARE campaigns, and drugs are evil, and, you know, if you choose to do them, you're a bad person. We got to lock people up and come down hard here on that issue, and it was seen as a real moral failing, and even by some as, you know, it's a sinful thing and all this sort of stuff. And so, it's something we've grown up with in our society, and we have adopted drug prohibition because of, you know, combination of racism. It was created, actually, as I did the research, it turned out it was because we wanted to, as a country, exclude Chinese Canadians. We didn't want them here after they finished building the railroad. British Columbia tried to shut that down real quick and enacted a whole series of racist laws, and eventually the federal government took on that mantle and criminalized opioids, and really in the name of racism. But it was also out of claims of morality, too. It was seen as an immoral behavior, and it needed to be criminalized. And so I think we've really grown up with that in society, that not just that drugs are bad, but that people who use drugs are bad. Those are two different things, right?
Yeah.
And so we have blamed and judged people. And in the context of the opioid crisis, it's really horrific. People are being blamed for dying. I mean, you can't think of some worse level of stigma. When I did this research, I came across a report by the World Health Organization, and they did a survey of 14 countries around the world, including Canada. And they said, who do you hate the most, basically, right? Who do you have the most stigma or social opprobrium for? And at the most reviled are people who use drugs, even worse so than people with leprosy. So the level of blame and condemnation is through the roof for people who use drugs, and they are blamed for their own death. And I really had a change of heart in understanding people who use drugs as I began to get into the research, talking to people, hearing about the stories, the journeys of people, that what leads people to a place of coming to habitually and addictively use substances, and particularly street drugs. And the stories I heard were really, really heartbreaking. The most dramatic I heard was from a judge in Vancouver. I asked her, I said, who are the people who are showing up in your courts who have got the long rap sheets? You know, who are committing all these thefts of autos and breaking and stealing stuff from Shoppers Drug Mart and being, you know, having, who are the real tough cases, and how did they get there? And she said, you know, it's not just one person. There's multiple people, she gave as an example, who happened to be Indigenous men, who were toddlers when they saw their mothers murdered in front of their own eyes by their fathers, and they were left with the body for days.
So how do you address that trauma? And it's not just Indigenous people, but that trauma that obviously drives them to use drugs. I mean, there are institutional things, obviously, that I guess perpetuate some of these traumas still, right, in the system and the sort. So, I mean, how do you start going about taking those down?
You're absolutely right. I mean, and the types of things we're talking about, it is intergenerational trauma. Mm-hmm. It's also personal trauma, so childhood trauma. It turns out that someone with moderate childhood trauma is 7 to 10 times more likely to develop a substance use disorder. It also includes physical pain. People have been injured on the job. Mm-hmm. We even heard cases of police officers who were injured on the job, prescribed opioids, and then to get back at work, they had to get off those. They're cut off those. They are now addicted. And in fact, we even heard stories of first responders who are going to dealers on the street. Like literally the same dealers who are, you know, providing drugs to anyone else, the professional first responders, have gotten addicted. And the stigma for them to come out, imagine the police officer saying, you know, I have this drug addiction and I'm going to the very dealers in the same community that we're trying to shut down. What? You know, how could you ever come out with that kind of honesty, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do we deal with the pain and the trauma and the suffering? Well, the first thing is we need to stop blaming people who use drugs. And we need to stop punishing and threatening and condemning them. And that starts with ending the criminalization against them. The federal government has got all these poster and YouTube campaigns about end the stigma. Well, the fact is that drugs are still illegal. You cannot end the stigma for something or reduce the stigma when it still is illegal. So with one voice, the government is spending all this money saying, hey, it's okay to use, you know, it's okay if you use drugs because we don't want you to use alone and we don't want you to overdose. And you should, you know, be honest with people in your life. But on the other hand, they're spending billions of dollars on the criminal justice system to punish and incarcerate people who do use drugs. And so it's an absurd double standard that no one can believe, right? No one who uses drugs believes that they are able to be, you know, open and honest about this when it's still a crime, you know, with their family, with their employer, you name it. So that's the starting point. But we as a society have a lot of learning to do. We have a lot of compassion we need to bring. And that can come from many sources. And so in my book, I talk about that. You know, I talk about, you know, for some people, this is a human rights issue. And this is that, you know, people with substance use disorders are not to blame for using these substances. And so we need to treat them with dignity and respect. For other people, it's about equality. It's about treating people equally. For other people, and, you know, for my perspective now, as someone who went through a real journey and in coming to you know, very recently have a real meaningful and significant relationship with Jesus Christ, it's a spiritual connection for me. And, you know, 2/3 of Canadians are self-identifying as Christian. Right? So that's a lot. So 2 in 3 people say that they're Christian. So I think it's important to bring faith into the conversation. And, you know, if Jesus were here today, he would be in 2 places, you know, I believe. He would be walking the streets of places like the downtown Eastside, offering hope and compassion. He would not be condemning people. And he would also be in our churches and religious institutions calling us out as hypocrites. First going to church on Sunday and saying how great we are, grateful we are for God's mercy and forgiveness, and then ignoring the suffering in our community and supporting policies that are harmful and heaping condemnation and judging people who use drugs.
Yeah, you mentioned in that in the book. I mean, recovery has that component to it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Not religion per se, but certainly faith or spirituality that I think a lot of us forget.
Yeah, it's true, and you know, I want to be really clear too. Like, you know, and for where I approach from my faith is that, you know, people have to choose for themselves where they are going to place their hope.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, no one's getting anywhere in life, and you know, by being told or forced to believe anything, right? That is not only wrongful and immoral, but it's also contrary to what the Bible even says, right? So we need to be really careful when we're designing, you know, and offering recovery programs that people from all perspectives are able to have options for them.
Mm-hmm.
But it is true. The evidence backs it up that people who have a belief in something greater than themselves cling to that. And you know, we see it right now with the overdose crisis, with the opioid crisis, with the COVID-19 epidemic. People are looking for something beyond themselves. You know, I've experienced that in my own life. There's not a day that goes by now that I am not having to, you know, start it on my knees in prayer and admitting that I can't do it on my own. And I'm grateful that there's a God who loves all of us. And so we're all on our journey, though, and I don't expect or call on us to do anything other than to encourage people to seek what for them is going to fill that hole. And that is going to include things like trauma counseling, too. We don't provide that support, mental health support. Mm. You know, it's about being compassionate with people, and whatever the source of your compassion is, let's follow that.
Yeah.
And if you don't have compassion, please find it, because we absolutely need to have that sort of reaction to this, and not to follow this failed approach of blame and condemnation, which, by the way, is also very, very costly. Right?
Mm.
What's unbelievable is that our federal criminal justice system costs $5 billion a year, and the majority of people incarcerated have substance use disorders. So we're literally flushing money down the toilet while we're inflicting further damage on people who are already hurting.
So I'll ask you this as a lawyer, as a law professor. What role does the criminal justice system play? I mean, it obviously costs a lot of money, a lot of resources to take down, say, big-time operators, but it's also futile to take down the small-time drug dealer, because as soon as you take one out, another one fills its place. Does the criminal justice system have a role still to play?
Well, I don't believe it does at all. I mean, this is in the context of people who are using drugs, mm-hmm. it absolutely does not. Because these are medical issues. These are public health issues. They are not amenable to a criminal justice response. And so all the reasons that we have for enacting criminal law fail when you look at it in the context of people who use drugs, right? So mm-hmm. what are we trying to do with criminal law? First is we're trying to denounce behavior, say it's wrongful and bad. Like I said, blaming people for saying things, saying they're morally blameworthy. We can't say that anymore now that we know what we know about substance use disorders.
Right.
Deterrence is another big one, right? Someone with an addiction who is going to use, the definition of that disorder is that, you know, they are using despite the risk of the consequences that could happen to them. If someone's not going to stop using drugs with the risk of overdosing and dying, the threat of a criminal prosecution isn't going to have any other effect either. So deterrence fails. You know, look at rehabilitation. That's another objective. Our prisons are the worst and last place you want to send someone with a substance use disorder. Not only are they places that are going to inflict further trauma, but they are places where the research shows people still can access drugs, but not in the same quantity. So they rapidly lose tolerance. Then when they're released from prison, they are significantly at risk of overdosing and dying. And here in British Columbia, what we found was that 44% of people who overdosed in British Columbia had been recently incarcerated. And most of those people died within the first couple of weeks and months of being released because of this issue of reduced tolerance. So we are literally wasting money to imprison people and then putting them at risk of dying when they're released. It's not only immoral, but I believe it's a likely a violation of the charter as well.
So we've touched on the ideological but the political. I mean, you're a guy who has had two decades in politics, and so you actually write in the book, what I found fascinating was the challenges of, say, marginalized groups versus the so-called politically important to have a say in the system. Why do you think people in politics have those blinders on, and how do you think we change that?
Yeah, I mean, it is very, very obvious to me after over two decades involved in politics and government and public policy that the issues that get dealt with are the ones that are of concern to people who are constituencies that are politically important. Those are groups that vote in large numbers and proportion, that donate to political parties, that call radio talk shows, that contact their MPs and demand they take action. They are vocal and active. And the groups that don't tend to get their issues dealt with are those that are marginalized and politically unimportant for those reasons. And it's part of it's our, the big part of it is our system, right? Governments are trying to get elected. They're not enacting the best policies for dealing with these issues. They are doing it out of catering to groups and out of fear of what their constituencies would do if they were to do the right thing. And we see that right now. It's not just the Conservative Party. It's the same thing with the Liberal Party. You know, what we found in our research, quite shockingly, actually, is we had closed-door meetings that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had in Vancouver here at the height of the opioid crisis, where he said to senior officials in the BC government and as well a group of attended by a group of loved ones who had had people.
That's Leslie McBain's group, right?
Yeah, Mom Stopped the Harm. And what I had confirmed by both those sources, when they said, you've got to stop criminalizing people. We can't end this crisis unless that's part of it. That's not going to solve it, but that's part of it. And they told me that Prime Minister Trudeau said that he was having too hard a time at that point having cannabis legalized, that he could not take the step of decriminalizing other drugs. In other words, he put politics ahead of the best available recommendations and evidence during a public health emergency. Imagine if he or any other politician did that right now during COVID-19. It would be a national scandal, and they would be compelled to resign. And I wrote to Prime Minister Trudeau. I gave him a chance to correct the record, see if was he misunderstood, were they wrong. He never got back to me. And so we have to take that for what it is, which is that the reason we are continuing to criminalize people who use drugs has nothing to do with science, medicine, or a lack of, you know, recovery programming, which incidentally we have a lot of. Many recovery beds are in fact open. That's not the issue. It is because of a lack of political will to do the right thing, and because of a conservative party that has demonized drug users and campaigned on that for decades and raised funding off it as well. And that needs to stop.
So you also write in the book about the attempt to shut down Insight by the Harper government. You worked there for a year. You write in this book that it was a mistake. Do a lot of people in that you worked with at the time, I guess you don't talk to a lot of them nowadays, but do they think the same as you, or is it still in those ideological terms that they view this issue?
Well, you can see the evidence right now. Across Canada, we have provincial conservative governments before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, and certainly it's continued during, who have acted to curtail, freeze funding, and shut down supervised injection sites that have been already approved by Health Canada. Mm. And so we see this in Alberta with Premier Jason Kenney. We see it in Saskatchewan with Premier Scott Moe. And we see that in Ontario with Premier Doug Ford as well. Each of these three conservative premiers has stridently campaigned against these sites, either in public campaigns or now in their provincial budgets. They're not funding them. Premier Kenney ordered a review, which was so flawed that a group of scientists have called for it to be retracted. He's claimed to use that as a basis for, you know, not supporting these sites, even though there's over 100 peer-reviewed studies and the Supreme Court of Canada confirming that they are needed to save lives. So it is completely putting politics in front of people's lives, and I believe that history will judge these politicians very, very harshly. The opioid crisis is not over. It is continuing, and it will likely continue through the COVID-19 situation. There's no sign of it stopping. It's only going to stop if we change our policy approach dramatically, or enough people die that it eventually wears down by raw attrition. And that would be the catastrophic worst-case scenario that many people fear is happening now and will happen if we don't act.
That's the other thing that I found fascinating about your book, is because you talk about your experience working in these offices in Ottawa, on this issue, it was driven by politics, it was driven by ideology, and in some instances, the whole story wasn't there, or the access to facts was limited, or they just didn't want to read that stuff,
yeah,
if you will.
Willful blindness.
Yeah,
willful
so blindness. Are there other issues that other public policy issues other than say opioid addiction that, I mean, you still see that with this current government, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's something that, you know, all parties need to guard against, but, you know, going through this book has been a real journey for me. I mean, it's like I say, I've kind of had both a change of heart on this issue, but yeah, the next obvious question for me is, well, what about other policies that I had, you know, when you sign up for a political party, you go usually do that because there's a few issues you're concerned about, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, it was things like supporting victims of crime, right? And, you know, lower taxes and stuff like this at the time were important to me somehow as a 16-year-old. I don't know why 16-year-olds care about that. They don't pay any taxes. Ridiculous, right? Didn't want anyone taking what little money you had, even though you weren't going to get taxed on it. But anyway, whatever. It's just a stupidity of youth. But, you know, you have a few issues, and then you sign on to a platform, and that means you're signing on to literally hundreds of policies you've never even thought about. And what's valued in politics is loyalty. So, you know, even if you are going to, you know, speak out privately and, you know, close door meetings and stuff, you're expected to toe the party line publicly. And if you don't, you're persona non grata. You're cut off. And so that's our party system. It's very damaging. It's very unhealthy for a democracy. And it's very devastating when it comes to having, you know, effective public policy responses. So, you know, there are a number of other areas that I am in the midst of rethinking and working on, including things like our entire criminal justice system, the system of incarceration that we have, issues with respect to the environment and reconciliation with Canada's Indigenous people, you know, things like basic national income. You know, it sounds like, you know, really progressive sort of stuff, right, to be shifting to. And for me, the three things that have led me to this point are, like, setting aside partisan politics, just put that, take those blinders off, right, following the policy evidence, and for me, you know, putting my, for my own personal journey in life, is for me, my faith has become much more significant for me. And so I'm not willing to let a political party or tell me what to think or, you know, be blindly loyal to them. And so there's a lot of people who I think are also independently minded in Canada. A lot of people change their votes between elections as between parties.
Sure.
And I think that's a good thing. And we really do need to rely much more on evidence in public policy and less on polling data and, you know, trying to garner votes through fear mongering. But unfortunately, that stuff works. I mean, that's why it's done. It works. People vote out of fear.
You mentioned in the book that you grew up in Alberta. How much of that do you think affected your early political thinking?
Well, even before that, you know, if you look at some of the roots of people's party support, it goes back generations. Mm. And for me, my family, I was raised as a Protestant conservative, and that meant that, you know, from hundreds of years ago, you know, that was, you would not vote liberal because liberals were the party of Catholics and the conservatives were the party of the Protestants. I remember hearing that from my grandfather. He's a wonderful man who taught me a lot of good things, but he reminded me of that. And that was, you know, a very interesting kind of perspective that you would have had from Ontario at that time. Uh-huh. From when he was raised in the early 1900s. He lived through the Spanish flu. He was a young man, and they quarantined in their house for 14 days and he had nothing to read but a Bible. That's all he had. There's no Netflix back then.
Yeah.
And, you know, so some of this goes back very far. And I think it's really important that throughout our lives we be open to change and growing and admitting when we're wrong. And I deeply regret that I supported the policies of the Conservative Party that blamed and condemned drug users and based on no evidence. And it was really very much ideology and ignorance combined. And, you know, I was not involved in decisions like the Insight case. That was before I got there, and the laws that were brought in to, you know, increase drug penalties, that was all before I spent my year in the Prime Minister's office. But I regret not using that time that I did have. It is a lost opportunity in 2012 to have spoken some truth to power on this issue, which I, you know, which I did do on other issues.
And to be reasonable, I guess you were tied up with other things, as we found out a few years later, right?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, that public court case was a pretty small part of my day.
I see.
It became a big issue, but it was a pretty small part of my job. I was responsible for assisting with managing litigation across the Government of Canada and all the, you know, justice, public safety, and immigration law files. That's a big job for a, you know, 30-something to have. And,
yeah,
you know, I think there are some things I'm proud of that I did in Ottawa, but it also, unfortunately for me, was a time where I, you know, relied on things like alcohol, you know, like other distractions and things that were unhealthy. And it's unfortunately, you get a, you know, big position like that as a young man or young woman, it affects your ego at some point. So I had a lot of pride I had to deal with, and you know, I've really had to you know, come to understand my own flaws. And that's been helpful for me on this issue as well. You know, why do people use drugs? Well, you know, why did I turn to other stuff as well that was, you know, unhealthy for me and self-destructive? And ultimately, we are all loved by God, but we're also desperately in need of redemption. And I, for myself, I've seen that. And I think having that humility is really important. And it's tough to have that in politics. I don't know how that gets any better, but at least as an individual now, I am very grateful for the opportunity to kind of have done this research, to have learned tremendously from the, not just the medical experts and such, but the people who are really honest with me, you know, people who are police officers saying, we can't prosecute our way out of this thing. We actually think we need to take a different approach. Yeah. That was really honest and courageous of them.
Uh-huh.
And I'm grateful for them, you know, speaking that way to me and putting that on the record. They know the police know that this isn't working, criminalizing people.
You also write at the end of the book about how we talk about these things, because there's obviously so much stigma. There's a lot of this that's in the shadows, and that's why it's become a problem. You write in the book about talking to children about what's happening in this country with regards to the opioid crisis. What have you found useful in terms of talking to your own kids? You have young children, right?
Yeah, I do. And so, you know, we live in East Vancouver, really, you know, nice neighborhood, but it's definitely near a major street where we have seen, you know, drug paraphernalia, and one of our kids' preschools a few years ago had to have their playground shut down because it was near a liquor store and there were needles found in the playground. So, you know, we've been around these issues, condoms in the street from, you know, sex trade workers, stuff like that. So we've had to, you know, talk to our kids about drugs and things like that. And we just, I'm kind of following the information I got, which is you just be upfront with them, you be honest with them from a very early age. And, you know, the best kind of age-appropriate information I had for my kids when they were, you know, four to six was that, you know, people are using these drugs because they're feeling in pain or they're sad and they're trying to feel better. And the drugs do make them feel better for a little while, but they're dangerous. And some people even die from taking them. And then we talk about what are some healthy things that we can do when we're feeling sad or when we're feeling lonely. And, you know, that's really it. It's no longer about scaring and fear-mongering. That stuff doesn't work. You know, the research shows that trying to scare people straight doesn't actually stop. In fact, it makes it worse, as research found. It makes people more likely to experiment with drugs. And being honest with our children, being knowledgeable is important. Understanding what the names are of street drugs, what currently is, you know, showing up in parties, because a lot of parents don't even know their children are using drugs. You know, I talked to a family a few weeks ago in Ontario and Quebec, and their daughter was in her early 20s, and these parents had no idea that she used injection drugs, no idea at all. And one day they showed up in her room, and she was deceased. And, it was a tragic case, and the illicit drugs. I'm not sure if it was injection, actually, now that I think of it, but they had no idea. They had no idea. And so when they say it could happen to anyone, you have to hear that and realize this is a upper middle class family. They had professional jobs, you know, they were not immune. And, you know, I start the book by talking about an overdose of, you know, close to a dozen young people who at a party just thought they would try a little bit of cocaine that someone brought. You know, it's pretty glamorized drug in the movies. It's not fentanyl, right? Well, it turned out it was laced with fentanyl. Every street drug, with the exception of cannabis, has been found to be laced with fentanyl at some point in time in Canada. And so we need to be very, very mindful of that, the risk that exists for us. We, you know, another case in the book was a wedding. Imagine this, right? Someone at a wedding. Yeah. Someone brought some drugs into the party. Next thing you know, people in a hotel room overdosed and one of them died. So this is stuff that's real. It's happening. We don't hear about it. It's an invisible crisis, and I hope that that my book will help make it more visible.
You talk in the book to a number of people. A lot. The other thing that struck me as I was reading the book, there are a lot of people. I mentioned Leslie McBain a moment ago, Sarah Blythe with the Overdose Prevention Society. A lot of these people who work outside of the system to effect change. You dedicate the book to Douglas Nickerson. What can we learn from his example?
Well, this is a really remarkable man. He homeless man who in Surrey during the height of the opioid crisis, when there was some people remember this, was sort of basically a tent city, you know, whole block of
the strip,
and he would go up and down on his bicycle with naloxone kit reviving people, and he saved countless lives, and he died of I believe it was pancreatic cancer or something like this, you know, tragically died. This guy's a hero. You know, he's most people would see that. See, it's the bottom of the barrel, the bottom of his life. He didn't have anything to offer to society from the perspective of anyone else. But he was using what he could do in that moment to help people. And how much more do those of us who are of means and other abilities and have the opportunity to act and help, how much more of an obligation do we bear? And so, yeah, so I dedicated the book to him. These are some of the forgotten heroes of the overdose crisis. You know, people would be surprised to maybe hear that most overdoses today are not reversed by professional first responders. They play a crucial role, and I really value their massive contribution. Yeah. They've done a lot, but in fact, most of them are reversed by peers and friends. Peers are being people who are fellow people who use drugs. And in fact, there's been a lot of research now coming in showing that people are more likely to go into a place like an overdose prevention site where there's going to be people who are like them, who aren't wearing a uniform and that are there and they know drugs and they know how to respond. And, you know, even the fire department here in Vancouver said, look, we are kind of new to this overdose response stuff. But, you know, when you're looking at injecting someone with naloxone, he said, you know, the people who really know how to do that pretty quickly and aren't afraid to do that are people who have been using injection drugs for most of their life, right? And they're turning what has been for them, you know, the debilitating chains of addiction, breaking those chains, and now are giving back and supporting. And it's not an on-off thing with substance use, right? We have this sort of idea that someone stops using their cold turkey or something their whole life. The best available, you know, medical evidence at this point is that, yeah, people who want to stop using, that there are potentially opportunities there. There's, you know, medications like methadone and Suboxone, which can support them in that, and there are other treatments and support. But what we do know is that abstinence-based treatment alone, so this sort of detox-alone model, is not recommended. It, in fact, is correlated with a greater risk of overdose and dying. So when you hear politicians talking, you know, in different parts of Canada, not so much here in BC, but in Alberta in particular, Ontario, about how we need more detox, that actually is the last thing we need. Detox kills people. Mm-hmm. If that's all you're offering people, you're at a higher risk of overdosing and dying if you complete your detox program. What a tragedy, especially when the families, you know, are mortgaging their homes and cashing in their RRSPs to pay for, you know, costly detox programs that don't have any medical evidence to back them up. So, you know, we need to have a real conversation about recovery and treatment as well, and realize that some of our myths and assumptions about treatment are wrong.
I could talk all afternoon with you about this book. It's an engaging book. I appreciate your time today. Congratulations and good luck with it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
The book is called Overdose, Heartbreak, and Hope in Canada's Opioid Crisis. It is published by Viking. Visit overdosebook.ca. for the virtual launch Thursday, the 16th of April, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Benjamin Perrin, the book's author, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plotin.